Human Resources and Intergovernmental Relations Subcommittee of the House of Representatives Government Operations Committee, where he conducted oversight of enforcement of federal health and safety laws. In 1993, Zeller joined the staff of then FDA Commissioner Dr. David Kessler and served as Associate Commissioner and Director of FDA's first Office of Tobacco Programs. Instrumental in crafting the agency's 1996 tobacco regulations, Zeller also represented FDA before Congress, federal, and state agencies. Zeller also served as an official U.S. delegate to the World Health Organization's Working Group for the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. We are very fortunate to have such an experienced and knowledgeable director as Mitch Zeller. Mitch?
Thank you, Carolyn, and good morning, everybody. And on behalf of FDA's Center for Tobacco Products, I want to welcome all of you in the auditorium and viewing the webcast to our public workshop on e-cigarettes. Electronic cigarettes, or e-cigarettes, are a novel and diverse category of tobacco products and the prototype of a broader category of products frequently referred to by the tobacco control and scientific communities as electronic nicotine delivery systems, or ENDS. E-cigarettes have gained significant attention in the marketplace and in the media over the past few years. These products have the potential to be a major factor affecting the premature death and disease caused by tobacco products. They may help to reduce the adverse impact of tobacco products by encouraging or helping people to completely quit smoking combusted products. Or they could increase the adverse impact by discouraging tobacco product cessation, encouraging long-term dual use of combusting and non-combusting products, or increasing tobacco use among non-users. The precise impact on population-level health of e-cigarettes for now is unknown, and limited data are available about their worldwide impact. Countries differ in their approach to e-cigarette regulation and have instituted a wide variety of policies relative to sale or use. Most public health officials are calling for more data to more fully understand the potential risks and benefits of e-cigarettes in order to inform regulatory action. In 2009, the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act was signed into law. It granted FDA immediate authority to regulate cigarettes, cigarette tobacco, roll-your-own tobacco, and smokeless tobacco. And as everyone now knows, it gave the agency the authority to include other categories of tobacco products within its jurisdiction that meet the statutory definition of a tobacco product through a rulemaking exercise known as deeming. FDA does not currently regulate e-cigarettes as tobacco products. In 2008 and 2009, the agency took enforcement actions against certain imported e-cigarettes, declaring them to be unapproved drugs or devices. In 2010, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit determined that e-cigarettes and other products made or derived from tobacco can be regulated as tobacco products under the Tobacco Control Act and are not drugs or devices unless they are marketed for therapeutic purposes, such as an aid to smoking cessation. In April of this year, FDA published a proposed rule to regulate additional categories of tobacco products. If the deeming rule is finalized as proposed, e-cigarettes that are tobacco products would be subject to FDA regulation under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The purpose of this workshop, the first of a series of three planned workshops, is to better inform FDA about e-cigarettes and other ENDS products. Should the agency move forward as proposed to regulate e-cigarettes, additional scientific information about the products will help the agency in carrying out its responsibilities under the law. We want to emphasize that the information presented and discussed during the workshop is not intended to inform the agency's rulemaking related to deeming additional tobacco products. But FDA intends to use information developed through this workshop series and from other sources to help inform future regulatory action and decisions related to these products. The Tobacco Control Act mandates that FDA consider the population health effects of tobacco products and potential regulatory actions, taking into account impacts on both users and non-users of the products in question. It is our job to use regulatory science to evaluate the likelihood that e-cigarettes will reduce and not increase harm from tobacco product use at the population level. But we must also evaluate the risks associated with use of these products. FDA makes decisions based on science and will use the available science to inform regulation. FDA intends to carefully consider the evidence and make full use of our regulatory authorities to protect public health. E-cigarettes are a key regulatory science research priority for FDA. Research to address e-cigarette knowledge gaps is being funded by grants administered through NIH and through internal FDA research. The Center for Tobacco Products is funding 37 research projects related to e-cigarettes to better understand the impact of these products on both users and non-users. The ongoing and funded research is likely to provide further information about the characterization of some e-cigarette devices, e-liquids, and aerosols, and a better understanding of e-cigarette users, reasons for use, abuse liability, user perceptions, health effects, and use behaviors. An analysis of these and other research efforts will help inform an assessment of the impact of e-cigarettes on the public health. The workshop today and tomorrow focuses on various aspects of product science. Two additional workshops on e-cigarettes are being planned. One will focus on the impact of e-cigarettes on the individual user, and one will on the impact of these products on the population as a whole. FDA has opened a docket for the public to submit additional information to the agency. The issues to be explored and the information to be shared in these three workshops will also help inform our thinking about one of the center's strategic priorities, the need to develop a comprehensive agency-wide nicotine regulatory policy. We all know that cigarettes will kill half of all long-term users prematurely. While 90% of adult smokers started smoking as kids, and half become addicted before turning 18. The premature deaths of long-term smokers addicted to the nicotine in cigarettes are caused by other toxins in tobacco and smoke linked to cancer, lung disease, and heart disease, not the nicotine. It's why we say that people smoke for the nicotine but die from the tar. Now, for years, the spectrum of nicotine-containing products in the United States has ranged from the most harmful, cigarettes, to the least harmful, nicotine replacement therapy cessation aids. With the advent of e-cigarettes and other novel products, there's an increasing diversity of nicotine-delivering products. There is now the potential to have products that contain only nicotine derived from tobacco rather than the tobacco itself, to be marketed as tobacco products or as drugs or as devices. Having a continuum of nicotine-containing products that can potentially cross jurisdictional lines within FDA, tobacco products versus, for example, cessation aids, creates the potential and the need for a comprehensive nicotine strategy here at FDA. A goal of a comprehensive nicotine regulatory policy could be to optimize the development and use of nicotine cessation products and to regulate other nicotine-containing products in order to maximize the potential benefits, such as by encouraging complete substitution of the most harmful forms of nicotine with the cleanest products, while minimizing initiation of use, delayed cessation, or relapse back to combusting products. Food for thought as we kick off the first of our three e-cigarette workshops. So let me again welcome everyone to today's workshop. We appreciate the attention that this subject brings and realize that there are many different interests represented. FDA is a science-based organization, and regulatory decisions will be guided by the regulatory science. So while many may hold strong opinions, we are focused on the scientific evidence that can help inform our future actions related to these products. I would now like to introduce Dr. Beth Dermowitz from our Office of Science, who will provide an overview of our workshop proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch, and good morning. I, too, would like to welcome you to day one of our first workshop on e-cigarettes. I would like to spend just a few minutes setting the stage for the day and going over some logistical information. The purpose, as mentioned by Mr. Zeller, of the workshop is to gather scientific information about this novel category of products. As Mr. Zeller mentioned, the workshop is not intended to inform the agency's proposed deeming rule. We are not looking for advice or for consensus, but are interested in an open exchange of scientific information. We acknowledge that e-cigarettes present complex regulatory and scientific challenges, and that there are strong opinions about these products and about their potential impact on the public health. However, we request that all workshop participants be considerate and respectful of all other participants, the information being presented, and the opinions expressed by others. We have asked all speakers and panelists to voluntarily disclose any financial interest that they may have in e-cigarettes, other electronic nicotine delivery systems, or any other relevant products or companies. As Mr. Zeller mentioned, the focus of today's presentations are related to product science. We have organized the day's presentations into three sessions that will be followed by time for clarifying questions as well as panel discussion. The sessions today are on device designs and characteristics, the chemical constituents in e-liquids and aerosols, and the toxicological considerations for e-liquids and aerosols. In addition, due to a speaker scheduling conflict, we will have a presentation on child-resistant packaging today, followed by two additional presentations on protective packaging tomorrow. Our agenda is full, hence our presenters have been asked to keep their presentations within the limited period allotted, and a timer will be used in order to stay on time. We'll have a short break in the morning and in the afternoon, and an hour break at lunchtime. Please bring all your personal items and belongings when you leave the room. We will end the day at 5. For those who have clarifying questions for a speaker or a question for the panel, if you are here on site, please write down your questions on one of the cards that should be available throughout the room and promptly give your card with the question to one of our volunteers that will be standing at the sides. If you are participating by webcast, you can email your questions to the e-cigarette workshop website, which you should have. It's workshop in lowercase .ctpos, all caps, at fda.hhs.gov. I would like to remind you that the use of tobacco products is prohibited in all FDA-occupied facilities. This policy applies to all interior space and outside grounds and to the use of all tobacco products. This includes cigarettes, e-cigarettes, cigars, pipe, chew, and dissolvable tobacco products. We ask that you respect this policy. Violators will be asked to leave the campus. The restrooms can be found out the doors on your right and down the hall to the right. Food and beverages will be available at the kiosk in the reception area during the breaks and at lunchtime. Please note that any media inquiries, Jennifer Holiski is our contact. Jenny is standing at the back on the right. Thank you, Jenny. And I would now like to turn the podium over to our moderator for the workshop, Dr. Carolyn Dressler.
Okay, let's get to it. Okay, so the first session that we have this morning is device design and characteristics. And we are going to start off with the first speaker. And let me just say during that we're going to keep the introduction short. If you want to know more about the speakers and their background, short bios, those are available outside. But for time purposes, too, I'll just keep it short and say the organization that the person is affiliated with. So they will be short. Our first speaker is Dr. Cliff Watson from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, speaking on overview of device designs and potential design risks. As you're coming up, Dr. Watson, to the podium, let me just point out that we have the buttons here. Yellow means you're getting short. Red means stop. If you see me stand up, that's a subtle hint. As I walk towards you, I get less subtle. Okay? Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. And I control the slides here with this device.
There, and then if you want to point, this is so the people online can see.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Very interesting topic today. I've been tasked with giving an overview of sort of device design, and also do want to cover just a little bit of the history. I think it's very interesting and fascinating and sort of shows where we've come from and potentially where we may be going. So I think everyone probably is familiar with this. The modern e-cigarette sort of owes its history to a Chinese pharmacist named Han Li. who developed the patented the modern sort of forerunner of the modern e-cigarette design in 2003. There was actually an earlier device that was marketed or sort of invented in 63, sort of a larger device, but it didn't really make any, it didn't have any commercial success. I'm sure my slides are dated already, but my team has told me there's over 450 e-cigarette brands out there with about 7,500 unique flavors, and we can see in some of the slides I showed that this is a rapidly expanding. There are a lot of questions, as Mitch alluded to, about what is exactly an e-cigarette, what's his role, what's his niche moving forward. I think this is a food for discussion for today, and presumably we'll hear a lot about this as we move on. I won't be touching on that really. I'll move on to the next slide here. Not too much market share data. I'm not an economist or anything, but just as fascinating to me to sort of showing this slide, which comes from Wells Fargo, about sort of the rapid rise in the sales of e-cigarettes, as it showed their increasing popularity. And with the industry analyst projection by 2017 that the market may hit $10 billion. If you sort of track this, you're sort of following exponential growth, which is fascinating. So many of the initial commercial products were developed by sort of independent companies. This was has now been really broadened, and a lot of the traditional tobacco companies are now marketing e-cigarette products, including companies like R.J. Reynolds, British American Tobacco, Altria, Imperial, Swisher. I think that's all that's on my slide there. The point of this is to say that e-cigarettes really sort of have sort of hit the mainstream. We're seeing a lot of interest in it from a lot of different companies. So getting to the meat of my talk here. So there's many different e-cigarette designs. For lack of better terminology, I'm going to break these down into two large categories, sort of cigarette-like, or the term I've heard is cig-like. We'll sort of stick with that nomenclature. There's different types. We'll touch on these here in just a second in terms of disposables, some that are non-refillable, and then there are some that are refillable, either by adding a liquid e-juice to them or by replacing a cartridge. Then you have the non-cigarette-like, and I'm going to generally refer to these as tank systems, again, for lack of better nomenclature. If anyone has better nomenclature, I really would like to do this because there's such a diversity of these products, it's hard to sort of keep track of what exactly we're talking about. And generally, these non-cigarettes are a little bit larger. They may look bigger, fatter, like cigars, or they may look totally different and sort of look like some sort of musical instrument almost in some of the very large ones. Then we're going to touch briefly on some of the design features in terms of some of the new things in terms of dual coil and voltage tunable. And I just want to say that the information I'm presenting today really I've pulled from a variety of sources, both from scientific publication as well as from like consumer blogs on the internet, and I've identified where everything's coming from. And so a lot of the information here, I mean, this is a very new area, and so we're pulling information from where we can to sort of, get a better picture of what's going on in terms of e-cigarette use design and a little bit on consumer perception, because that might drive some of the design innovations like dual coil or other innovations in the product design. So I'm sure everyone in the audience here is familiar with anatomy of an e-cigarette, three major components. In this case, you have the battery, which would be in the traditional cigarette, the cigarette tobacco filler rod. You have the reservoir containing the e-juice, which is in the filter component. And then in between, you have the electronics and the resistive heating coil, which when the user takes a puff on the device, a switch is activated, current from the battery is dumped into the resistor heats up, it vaporizes some of the e-juice, which then very quickly cools, condenses, and that's the condensation vapor that when you see the user inhaling, or not see it inhaling, but blowing back out. Generally, the little heater unit here can be called atomizers. We'll say there's also other names, cartomizers and other types as well. Oops. Sort of a very simple sort of tank system. This looks just sort of like a bigger e-cigarette. Essentially, same type of device design. You have a battery component, you have the heater element, you have a reservoir, some sort of a wicking to bring the e-juice up to the heating element to be vaporized, and of course a mouthpiece. One of the interesting things about the tank system being larger, you could have bigger batteries, higher capacity batteries, and presumably you have more room in there for having other electronics circuitry. I'm not really going to touch on that, but one of the key features we've seen in some of the newer systems is actually having a little button which basically, instead of the device being actuated by having someone draw on it with a puff, you actually have sort of a button you can push that sort of pre-warms the heating element so that there's no time lag where the heating element heats up to get the aerosol generation started. Very quickly, I promise not to show any more market share data. The reason I put this slide up is just to show that if you sort of broadly look at these in terms of the sort of e-cigarette cigalike versus the larger tank system, you see that both represent significant chunks of the market. The tank system is obviously more expensive, and so this doesn't really reflect sort of the number of sticks or units sold, but I only show this just to show that both types are very important and I think need to be included in discussion moving forward. So some of the factors that can influence vapor delivery, and I'm sure we'll see a lot of talks about this today and over the course of the workshop. Voltage, obviously, the chemistry of the e-juice, whether the solvents typically used, propylene glycol or glycerin, other additives, nicotine, obviously. How these things are used in terms of the puff topography, puff duration, puff volume, puff profile. Of course, when we're talking about the puff profile shape, bell shape versus square wave, we're really talking about machine smoking for device testing purposes, which I believe we'll touch on today quite a bit. There needs to be some work done in this area to come up with a consistent way to look at these devices. But of course, if a person's smoking, they're smoking however they smoke. They're not smoking with a square wave or a bell wave. But you do have individual difference in users. And from what I've read, it generally varies between sort of non-experienced users and experienced users. And then with experience, you may change. There may be some learning curve to learning how to sort of optimize, you know, your expected delivery from the devices. Engineering factors, obviously, the things like the wick design, how efficient you can get the liquid to the coil, making sure that that's there's an uninterrupted supply. And then, of course, other design factors, things like draw resistance, atomizer design, whether or not you have a single or a dual coil, the type of atomizer, the heating element, the resistance that goes into that, and also, as I pointed out, whether or not you're relying on taking a drag off the e-cigarette device to basically close a switch from some sort of pressure sensor versus having some sort of automatic activation by a button or other means. So one of the things I was asked to discuss was a little bit about the relationship sort of from a fundamental physics point of view, and I apologize if I bore everyone going back to sort of physics 101 here about the relationship between voltage, current, resistance, and power. Looking at equation one, this is just standard basic physics. The voltage is equal to the current times resistance. In equation two, you've got power is equal to the current squared times the resistance. And if you rearrange equation one, you substitute equation two by doing a little bit of algebra, if you can remember how to do that. I struggle with that these days. Luckily, I have kids in high school. Well, I had kids in high school or in college now, but I had to go back and redo some of my basic maths over the last decade. But then you get power is equal to voltage squared divided by resistance. And so what that is interesting because that means that if you have a twofold increase in voltage, you get a fourfold increase in power in the device. And what is implication of that? Well, I'll go back to your basic circuitry design. This is a very simplistic sort of electronic schematic of an e-cigarette. You have a battery. You have a resistor. This would be your heater coil over here. You have some sort of switch, which is either controlled by flow or by manual actuation. When the switch closes, you draw a current through the system, the resistor heats up, and if you have, say, a battery at 3 volts or 6 volts, you know, what happens if you increase the voltage of the battery? So if you assume, and this is a simplified assumption, that the resistor coil here acts as a thermoresistor, you get this type of equation where the temperature of the coil is proportional to the initial temperature plus this term, which is related to the voltage squared, divided by K times the resistance, where K is a constant of the system. So at higher voltage, you get higher coil temperatures, generally speaking. And so this has been shown by a number of different researchers how the delivery changes as a function of voltage. And here we're looking at sort of nicotine and TPM delivery under fixed smoking conditions and a change of 3.7 volts to 5.2 volts. You see a much bigger jump in sort of nicotine delivery and TPM delivery, presumably reflecting that you're getting more power, more temperature to the coil, you're getting more vaporization and generating, you know, a larger, more dense aerosol. And not only nicotine and TPM go up with voltage, you also see increase in other constituents. In this case, we're looking at this particular paper looked at the delivery of select carbonyl compounds. And as you can see, as the voltage goes from 3.2 volts to 4.8 volts, you see a very large rise in the delivery of other constituents besides nicotine and TPM. Solvents can impact the carbonyl formation. I apologize for the slide. I don't really mean for you to read the slide. I just took this table directly from this paper. And they're looking at sort of different products or different e-cigarette designs that have different composition of the e-juice, looking at products that have propylene glycol, glycerol, and then a mixture of the two, and then looking at the range of constituents they're getting. And the take-home message here is that you do see differences in the delivery of the products depending on the solvent that is used. That's not too surprising. I mean, you put different things in, you might expect to get different things out. Whether or not these minor differences you see in these deliveries have any toxicological relevance, we don't know yet, but it's interesting to see that the chemistry of the products themselves do, of course, affect the delivery that an end user would see. How people use the products basically really affect sort of the delivery that they get. Again, this is another paper. I can't remember if this is a paper or a poster presentation. I apologize. I have the reference in my briefcase if anybody has a copy of the reference if anybody wants to look at it. But basically taking a larger, generally slower puffs generally deliver more, as one would expect, delivery. In this case, we're looking at nicotine yield, but it would be delivery of other constituents as well. So I don't think that's terribly surprising. One of the interesting things to me is sort of the evolution of the products over time. In this case, I believe the first generation is talking about cigalec, where the new generation, the one that's traced in red there, is showing sort of the larger tank systems. In this particular graph, the researchers looked at nicotine plasma levels as a function of time and compared sort of the first generation device, the second to the new generation device, and then the green, which came from a separate publication, sort of cigarettes. And so the take-home message to me here is that you're now seeing the newer devices basically can give you the same increase in sort of plasma nicotine levels, although it takes longer than a cigarette. But we see with the evolution of the products, we are getting more efficient products, which presumably are more satisfying to the consumers because they more closely mimic how cigarettes work. There are a number of engineering design factors in the different types of products. One of the interesting design factors has been sort of the design of the cartridges that hold the e-juice. The traditional polyfill, which is generally used in the e-cigarettes, really hasn't changed all that much. You have the top-fed wick design, which basically is given away to, if you read the blogs and sort of what sort of the consumer preferences seem to be, the gravity-fed design seems to be winning out over the top-fed design. And then the different types of the cartomizers, where these might be something like you have the traditional polyfill cartridge on the inside here, surrounded by a larger clear reservoir, which you can see, so you know when it's time to top off your device or your e-juice is running low, which presumably keeps the wicks in here adequately moist and delivering constant and consistent amounts of e-juice to the vaporizer to generate a consistent puff-by-puff delivery. These designs vary in size and shape, going from a few mils of the e-juice up to, 5, 10, 15 mils in some of the larger design items. And so you have ones that basically are one-time use, they're refillable, or in some of these sort of larger clear designs, these are refillable, and as these get old, they're also user-replaceable. And then sort of several new sort of innovations have come on the market in the last few years. I think one of the more interesting designs to me is the sort of the dual coil design. Instead of having just one heater element and these different types of atomizers, they're available in all types, clearomizers, cartomizers, atomizers. You have devices now that have two coils in there. And I am not totally up to speed on this, But I think in some of these you can have sort of delayed sort of onset coil 1 versus coil 2 or both coils heat up at the same time. And this is really an engineering attempt to basically give, in my opinion, a sort of a more consistent smoke or higher volume of smoke so it's more consumably acceptable to the consumer. I don't think there's been any real work. I apologize if someone's published this recently on sort of the effect of the design delivery on sort of quantitative measurements that have been published. If I've missed a paper or two, I apologize. But if you go online and you look at sort of the blogs, there's quite a bit of discussion about the design A versus design B and sort of the perks of some of the newer designs in terms of being more appealing or more consistent. But again, these are just sort of blog sites, to take them with a grain of salt. There are many other factors that could affect delivery, both the consumer as well as for sort of standardized machine testing purposes. The draw resistance, they can vary in terms of the e-cigarette design. And the draw resistance is important because you have to have, particularly for the ones that are sort of actuated by taking a puff on them, you have to have sufficient draw to sort of engage the circuitry to sort of, so the sensor senses a puff's happening. It closes the circuit, you get current going through the resistor, and generation of e-solvent, sort of evaporation of the e-solvent. The resistor and the circuitry take a little bit of time to sort of engage, and so you can have sort of this time lag sort of between the initiation of puff and sort of, you know, a slow rise in sort of the aerosol density and distribution as the heater heats up, sort of reaching sort of a maximum, and then depending on the design, that may stay at a maximum or may tail back down. So under a conventional cigarette machine smoke testing paradigm where you're taking a two-second puff, some of these cigarettes maybe need a longer puff or a slower puff to get sort of a better dose of the e-cigarette vapor aerosol. And there's been a little bit of work done on this, looking at the time lag associated with this, and I think many people are suggesting you need to have to take a longer, maybe a 3 or 4 second puff under sort of machine testing. This is still up in, this is still an area that needs more work. Then you also have the interesting phenomena if you have a manual actuated device. You know, if you're going to do machine testing, how does one sort of accomplish that? And we need to work out sort of a consistent way to sort of come up with a testing regimen that's consistent between products, so when you're comparing publications from different labs, you know you're talking about being able to compare apples to apples versus apples to oranges. Of course, they're generating the aerosol differently. So very quickly, just summarizing today's presentation, I'd like to say that one of the take-home points from my perspective is that the landscape of product evolution is evolving very rapidly. We're seeing a lot of changes in the both the cigarette and the tank systems, maybe more so in the tank systems. And whether or not these markets are competing, the two types are competing with each other for different markets, I don't think that's well known, at least not to me as being a chemist. I'm some of the people that do other types of research on sort of the marketing and sort of the behavior may have a better answer for this. But clearly both are important. A number of the factors can impact delivery. We've touched on many of these today, voltage, solvent, how the devices are used in terms of puff-up topography, the engineering design in terms of the coil design, wick design, aerosol condensation, and how you actuate the devices. And of course, as many talks end, more work needs to be done really to fully understand how these devices work. So very quickly, I'd like to acknowledge the people in my group who basically keep me on my toes and keep me informed of what's going on there in the field and keep educating me on what's happening out there. And also special thanks to Joe Lisko, my group, for providing many of the slides that I showed today. Thank you very much.
Reminder, we'll do clarifying questions at the end. The cards are at the periphery of the room, and you can hold them up, and one of the volunteers will pick them up. If you have questions or if you're online, send your questions in, as Beth said earlier. Okay, good. Our next speaker is Samantha Gadd from Gadd Consulting Services, and she will be speaking on material hazards associated with e-cigarettes.
Backwards. First off, I wanted to thank FDA for inviting me to speak today. I was asked to give a thought-provoking discussion on material hazards associated with e-cigarettes. So a lot of this talk is just the things that I have thought about when I'm using my e-cigarette. I'm a chemical engineer, and I've been using an e-cigarette for a couple years now. I've had a lot of time to, you know, kind of think about the different materials, how they might act, interact, react with one another. So I feel that not only do we need to discuss the hazards associated with the materials of construction themselves, but also consider the changes in hazard over time given the use of the product, storage conditions, and other conditions. So what are some of these conditions that an e-cigarette might go through? I do have to admit that some of these are my experiences, but some of them are not, and a couple of them might be a little embarrassing. So sometimes an e-cigarette might be exposed to excessive heat, like being left in the car in the summer in the South, maybe exposed to excessive cold, being left in a car overnight in upstate New York, February. Might get dropped a lot. Possibly run over by a car. I don't think that happened, but there's a chance it had happened. Getting lost and then found a year later under the car seat, and then I used it. Chewing on it like a pen. That's not mine. That was volunteered by another e-cigarette user. And my dog thought it was a bone and then used it. This is also not mine. But these are some of the conditions that an e-cigarette may be exposed to. Now, when we think about the design of an e-cigarette, we've seen many designs already, and as you can see, they're very different. There's a wide variety. And exposure to excessive heat, excessive cold, being dropped on the ground, potentially being, you know, chewed, tapped on a desk, it could cause some failures in the materials. It could cause possible leaking from the cartridge holding the e-liquid. It could cause some materials to come into contact with materials that they're not initially intended to come into contact with. So I feel that that's also an important thing to consider when evaluating the material hazards associated with an e-cigarette. So in my opinion, this is a standard design of an e-cigarette. Now we're going to see a lot of standard designs of e-cigarettes over the next couple of days. The common e-cigarette components include a battery, flow sensor, aerosol generator, heaters, wicks, there's other nicotine storage. These designs vary, especially in what comes into contact with the e-liquid. Now, I feel there are two main areas of focus for materials. There's the direct consumer contact, being the label, the sticker, the mouthpiece, the parts of an electronic cigarette to which a consumer actually comes into direct contact with. There is also indirect consumer contact, which is what can get into the e-liquid or aerosol through particle migration, through just interactions, and so on. So for direct consumer contact, I feel that it's important to evaluate, the label, the sticker, the mouthpiece, any kind of battery exterior casing. Again, the designs of e-cigarettes vary a lot, but I do feel it's important to evaluate everything that will come into direct contact. And this needs to include any adhesives, and possibly consider use of either food-grade materials, ASTM metals, or other standard types of metals. You need to be concerned with what type of paints, colorants, or coatings you're using on your e-cigarette. And then also, if the parts are cleaned, does the cleaning clean before, after manufacturing and before packaging, does the cleaning process effectively remove contaminants? If these are machined, there could be metal shavings and other possible contaminants on direct consumer contact pieces. And also, does the cleaning process have a negative impact on any of the materials? Maybe you're using a harsh cleaner that is not appropriate to be used with your coatings with your labels with your adhesives. So I feel that also should be considered. We also need to consider the compounds which may migrate to those direct consumer contact parts, either leaking a e-liquid. I can't tell you how many times I've used my e-cigarette and some of the liquid comes out through the hole of the mouthpiece and either gets on, you know, my lips or onto the exterior of the e-cigarette itself. So what kind of impact does that have? Aerosol being redeposited onto the e-cigarette. Say you're smoking with e-cigarette still in your mouth and you exhale and the aerosol gets back, deposited back onto the exterior of the e-cigarette. Also, we may want to worry about particle migration from the battery and particle migration from the packaging, the exterior packaging that you would buy in the store, onto the e-cigarette, and also the any interactions between these and between the label, the mouthpiece, etc. For indirect consumer contact, this would be what gets into the e-liquid through contact with the e-liquid or the particle migration. So this is commonly referred to as leachables and extractables in the drug and medical device industry, where a leachable is a substance released from its material in contact with a liquid, typically called a solvent, and extractables are defined as compounds that migrate from a material under stressed conditions, such as elevated temperature, extreme surface exposure, aggressive solvent systems. Extractables and leachables can be organic, inorganic, metallic compounds. They can be elements. These particles may have charges. They may have different shapes, different sizes. And again, these leachables and extractables are compounds which can be released from the materials of construction into the e-liquid and possibly into the aerosol. The identification of compounds which can be leached or extracted sounds like it might be easy, but the compounds may be complex. Think about possible polymers, coatings, and then especially when you consider the matrix, the e-liquid itself, it's going to be difficult to evaluate what may have migrated from the materials into the e-liquid. Now we need to take into consideration the effects of time, temperature, repeated use. Remember leaving it in the car in the summer, maybe getting cold, maybe dropping it on the ground. Then also we need to consider product defects, which may occur from me dropping my e-cigarette on the ground multiple times. And additionally, product defects, which may just come from the manufacturer of the device, which may allow the e-liquid to come into contact with parts it's not intended to, say cracks, or again, from heat or cold, stress fractures, etc. on the device. Also, different materials of construction and different e-liquid composition may act or react differently. We'll talk about that a little more in a couple slides. Then also material degradation over time. So the cartridge portion of an e-cigarette, again, can vary widely. Depending on the design, almost all the interior contact of a cartridge, all the interior of a cartridge, could have indirect consumer contact. So materials that a sensor, reservoir, gaskets, coils, wicks, coatings, these can be made of metals, they can be made of silica, is common for some electronic cigarette designs, ceramics, we've seen in prior presentations already, and polymers. So leaching of these materials into an e-liquid, again, we may have metals, polymers, silica and ceramics. These can leach elements, organics, and inorganic compounds. Varies with the composition of the e-liquid. It's well known that different solvents or different e-liquid formulations may draw different compounds into a solution. So if you're looking at a menthol formulation versus a cinnamon flavor versus a vanilla flavor, it may cause different compounds to be leached or extracted into the e-liquid itself. This can be affected by time, temperature, pH of the solution of the e-liquid, a lipophilicity, different polarities and charges. Some thought needs to be put into what should be used for an extraction, what should be used to evaluate what might come from the material into the e-liquid itself, and maybe consider using the e-liquid in order to evaluate what might leach or extract from the material into the e-liquid. For aging, medical devices typically kind of look at T equals zero, so a freshly manufactured device, and T equals 2 years for shelf life. We don't know what's going to happen with an e-cigarette over time. Again, material degradation, the exposure conditions it's going to be exposed to. Also, e-cigarettes don't typically have an expiration date printed very obviously on them, and they do have expiration dates. If you look on websites, if you talk to manufacturers, they're not supposed to be used indefinitely, but a lot of them are used until they're lost, broken, indefinitely, and it might not be appropriate for the materials. They may not be able to withstand such long use. Battery. While battery is considered or typically kept separate from the consumer contact portion of the device, we need to be very careful to make sure it's not able to leak, overheat, explode. Again, remember, these things can be dropped on the ground. If it's not manufactured carefully, there can be a fairly high possibility for risk. Typical materials of construction for a battery can be nickel-cadmium, lithium-ion batteries, can be other nickel-metal hydrides, alkaline lithium polymers. There are more. There are many different types of batteries that can be used in e-cigarettes, and I know this is always changing. So how do we test, how do we evaluate the safety of the materials used? There are many methods that exist for the identification and quantitation of leachables and extractables into a solution, but what gets into an aerosol is actually going to be a bit more important. We may want to consider every component used in manufacture and then evaluate its individual safety as an alternative to evaluating compounds bound to leach and extract, or you might want to do a leaching and extracting study. There's a couple different ways you could evaluate this. So some test methods that are typically used for identification of leachable and extractable compounds are ICP-MS, ICP-OES, or ICP direct analysis. Now this is typically used for metals, elemental impurities in organic compounds. But there can be a lot of noise, so you need to have an experienced lab doing these tests. It's hard to tell if you have also the metal itself or possibly a charged metal and also what form. There can be a lot of difference in the toxicity of chromium-4 versus chromium-6. GCMS is also a method that could be used. It detects semi-volatiles and volatiles, and LCMS for non-volatiles. Now, all these compounds are different, and different analytical methods need to be used to evaluate them. FTIR is another method, but it's not necessarily great for identification of specific compounds. TOC, total organic carbon, is again, it's good for measurement of total organic carbon, but not for identification of compounds. It can give you a total level of carbon, organic carbon present, and also non-volatile residue. Again, it's not really good for identification of compounds, but it can be used to determine a total amount of compound found to leach or extract from a device. So there's a need to design testing methods, standard testing methods, for electronic cigarettes. It's not going to be cost prohibitive. There's a very nice document by PQRI, Product Quality Research Institute, which focuses on leachables and extractables in orally and inhaled nasal drug products. And this provides a nice flowchart, and it's not a 200-page document, it's very nice, on possible methods to evaluate leachables and extractables in, as it says, orally and nasally inhaled drug product, which I feel might be a good resource when we are developing test methods. Also, I want to point out that not all materials and vendors are created equal. Many polymers, metals, and even glasses and ceramics have varying ingredient compositions to change your performance characteristics. A polymer, polyethylene is not polyethylene, is not polyethylene. Different manufacturers can use different processes and they can have different impurities. Sourcing of materials is very important. You need to make sure your vendors are qualified and that GMP, good manufacturing processes, or GMP-like manufacturing processes should be used. In summary, we must consider both direct and indirect contact surfaces, effects of time, temperature, different e-liquid formulations, sources of materials, types of materials, and different types of particles require different testing methods. Thank you.